usual time for me, I expect, replied the monk. I'll show these two how to ring you. It was then that Webb realized there was a third man in the room. He was standing in the shadows at the far end, and the major recognized him instantly. He was Elliot Stevens, senior aide to the President of the United States. Some said his alter ego. He was in his early 40s, slender, wore glasses, and had the bearing of unpretentious authority about him. "He'll be fine," the imposing older man who had not found time to introduce himself had been speaking. Webb had not heard him, his attention on the White House aide. "I'll be waiting." "Till next time," continued Abbott, shifting his eyes kindly to the gray-haired woman. "Thanks, Sister Meg. Keep your habit pressed. And down. You're still wicked, Jesuit." The couple left, closing the door behind them. Webb stood for a moment, shaking his head and smiling. The man and woman of 139 East 71st belonged to the room down the hall, just as that room belonged in the brownstone, all a part of the quiet, moneyed, tree-lined street. "You've known them a long time, haven't you?" "A lifetime, you might say," replied Abbott. "He was a yachtsman we put to good use in the Adriatic runs for Donovan's operations in Yugoslavia. Mikhailovich once said he sailed on sheer nerve, bending the worst weather to his will. And don't let Sister Meg's graciousness fool you. She was one of Intrepid's girls, a piranha with very sharp teeth. They're quite a story." "It'll never be told," said Abbott, closing the subject. "I want you to meet Elliot Stevens. I don't think I have to tell you who he is. Webb, Stevens, Stevens, Webb." "That sounds like a law firm," said Stevens amiably, walking across the room, hand extended. "Nice to know you, Webb. Have a good trip?" "I would have preferred military transport. I hate those damn commercial airlines. I thought a customs agent at Kennedy was going to slice the lining of my suitcase." "You look too respectable in that uniform," laughed the monk. "You're obviously a smuggler." "I'm still not sure I understand the uniform," said the major, carrying his briefcase to a long hatch table against the wall and unclipping the nylon cord from his belt. "I shouldn't have to tell you," answered Abbott, "that the tightest security is often found in being quite obvious on the surface. An army intelligence officer prowling around undercover in Zurich at this particular time could raise alarms." "Then I don't understand either," said the White House aide, coming up beside Webb at the table, watching the major's manipulations with the nylon cord and the lock. "Wouldn't an obvious presence raise even more shrill alarms? I thought the assumption of undercover was that discovery was less probable." "Webb's trip to Zurich was a routine consulate check, predated on the G2 schedules. No one fools anybody about those trips. They're what they are and nothing else. Ascertaining new sources, paying off informants. The Soviets do it all the time. They don't even bother to hide it. Neither do we, frankly." "But that wasn't the purpose of this trip," said Stevens, beginning to understand. "So the obvious conceals the unobvious." "That's it." "Can I help?" The presidential aide seemed fascinated by the briefcase. "Thanks," said Webb. "Just pull the cord through." Stevens did so. "I always thought it was chains around the wrist," he said. "Too many hands cut off," explained the major, smiling at the White House man's reaction. "There's a steel wire running through the nylon." He freed the briefcase and opened it on the table, looking around at the elegance of the furnished library den. At the rear of the room was a pair of French doors that apparently led to an outside garden, an outline of a high stone wall seen dimly through the panes of thick glass. "So this is Treadstone 71. It isn't the way I pictured it." "Pull the curtains again, will you please, Elliot?" Abbott said. The presidential aide walked to the French doors and did so. Abbott crossed to a bookcase, opened the cabinet beneath it, and reached inside. There was a quiet whir. The entire bookcase came out of the wall and slowly revolved to the left. On the other side was an electronic radio console one of the most sophisticated Gordon Webb had seen.
"Is this more what you had in mind?" asked the monk.
"Jesus." The major whistled as he studied the dials, calibrations, cable patches, and scanning devices built into the panel. The Pentagon war rooms had far more elaborate equipment, but this was the miniaturized equal of most well-structured intelligence stations.
"I'd whistle too," said Stevens, standing in front of the dense curtain. "But Mr. Abbott already gave me my personal sideshow. That's only the beginning. Four more buttons and this place looks like a sack base in Omaha."
Those same buttons also transformed this room back into a graceful east side library. The old man reached inside the cabinet. In seconds, the enormous console was replaced by bookshelves. He then walked to the adjacent bookcase, opened the cabinet beneath, and once again put his hand inside. The whirring began. The bookcase slid out, and shortly in its place were three tall filing cabinets. The monk took out a key and pulled out a file drawer.
"I'm not showing off, Gordon. When we're finished, I want you to look through these. I'll show you the switch that'll send them back. If you have any problems, our host will take care of everything."
"What am I to look for?"
"We'll get to it. Right now, I want to hear about Zurich. What have you learned?"
"Excuse me, Mr. Abbott," interrupted Stevens. "If I'm slow, it's because all this is new to me. But I was thinking about something you said a minute ago about Major Webb's trip."
"What is it?"
"You said the trip was predated on the G2 schedules."
"That's right."
"Why?"
"The Major's obvious presence was to confuse Zurich, not Washington."
"Or was it?"
The monk smiled. "I can see why the President keeps you around. We've never doubted that Carlos has bought his way into a circle or two, or 10 in Washington. He finds the discontented men and offers them what they do not have. A Carlos could not exist without such people. You must remember, he doesn't merely sell death, he sells a nation's secrets. All too frequently to the Soviets, if only to prove to them how rash they were to expel him."
"The President would want to know that," said the aide. "It would explain several things."
"It's why you're here, isn't it?" said Abbott.
"I guess it is."
"And it's a good place to begin for Zurich," said Webb, taking his briefcase to an armchair in front of the filing cabinets. He sat down, spreading the folds inside the case at his feet, and took out several sheets of paper. "You may not doubt Carlos is in Washington, but I can confirm it."
"Where?"
"Treadstone."
"There's no clear proof of that, but it can't be ruled out. He found the fiche. He altered it."
"Good God, how?"
"The how I can only guess. The who I know."
"Who?"
"A man named Koenig. Until 3 days ago, he was in charge of primary verifications at the Gemeinschaft Bank."
"3 days ago. Where is he now?"
"Dead. A freak automobile accident on a road he traveled every day of his life." "Here's the police report. I had it translated." Abbott took the papers and sat down in a nearby chair. Elliot Stevens remained standing. Webb continued.
"There's something very interesting there. It doesn't tell us anything we don't know, but there's a lead I'd like to follow up."
"What is it?" asked the monk, reading. "This describes the accident. The curve, speed of vehicle, apparent swerving to avoid a collision. It's at the end. It mentions the killing at the Gemeinschaft, the bolt that got us off our asses."
"It does?"
Abbott turned the page. "Look at it. Last couple of sentences. See what I mean?"
"Not exactly," replied Abbott, frowning. "This merely states that Koenig was employed by the Gemeinschaft where a recent homicide took place, and he had been a witness to the initial gunfire. That's all."
"I don't think it is all," said Webb. "I think there was more. Someone started to raise a question, but it was left hanging,
I'd like to find out who has his red pencil on the Zurich police reports. He could be Carlos' man. We know he's got one there. The monk leaned back in the chair, his frown unrelieved.
Assuming you're right, why wasn't the entire reference deleted?
Too obvious. The killing did take place. Koenig was a witness. The investigating officer who wrote up the report might legitimately ask why.
But if he had speculated on a connection, wouldn't he be just as disturbed that the speculation was deleted?
Not necessarily. We're talking about a bank in Switzerland. Certain areas are officially inviolable unless there's proof.
Not always. I understood you were very successful with the newspapers.
Unofficially. I appealed to prurient journalistic sensationalism and, although it damn near killed him, got Walther Apfel to corroborate halfway.
Interruption, said Elliot Stevens.
I think this is where the Oval Office has to come in. I assume by the newspapers you are referring to the Canadian woman.
Not really.
That story was already out. We couldn't stop it. Carlos is wired into the Zurich police. They issued that report. We simply enlarged on it and tied her to an equally false story about millions having been stolen from the Gemeinschaft.
Webb paused and looked at Abbott.
That's something we have to talk about. It may not be false after all.
I can't believe that, said the monk.
I don't want to believe it, replied the major.
Ever.
Would you mind backing up? Asked the White House aide, sitting down opposite the army officer. I have to get this very clear.
Let me explain, broke in Abbott, seeing the bewilderment on Webb's face.
Elliot's here on orders from the president. It's the killing at the Ottawa airport.
It's an unholy mess, said Stevens bluntly.
The prime minister damn near told the president to take our stations out of Nova Scotia. He's one angry Canadian.
How did it come down? Asked Webb.
Very badly. All they know is that a ranking economist at National Revenue's Treasury Board made discreet inquiries about an unlisted American corporation and got himself killed for it. To make matters worse, Canadian intelligence was told to stay out of it. It was a highly sensitive U.S. operation.
Who the hell did that?
I believe I've heard the name Iron Ass bandied about here and there, said the monk.
General Crawford?
Stupid son of a bitch.
Stupid Iron Ass son of a bitch!
Can you imagine? Interjected Stevens. Their man gets killed, and we have the gall to tell them to stay out.
He was right, of course, corrected Abbott. It had to be done swiftly. No room for misunderstanding. A clamp had to be put on instantly, the shock sufficiently outrageous to stop everything. It gave me time to reach Mackenzie Hawkins. Mac and I worked together in Burma. He's retired, but they listened to him. They're cooperating now, and that's the important thing, isn't it?
There are other considerations, Mr. Abbott, protested Stevens.
They're on different levels, Elliot. We working stiffs aren't on them. We don't have to spend time over diplomatic posturing. I'll grant you those postures are necessary, but they don't concern us.
They do concern the president, sir.
They're part of his every working stiff day. And that's why I have to go back with a very clear picture.
Stevens paused, turning to Webb.
Now please, let me have it again. Exactly what did you do and why? What part did we play regarding this Canadian woman?
Initially, not a goddamn thing. That was Carlos' move. Someone very high up in the Zurich police is on Carlos' payroll. It was the Zurich police who mocked up the so-called evidence linking her to the three killings. And it's ludicrous. She's no killer.
All right, said the aide. That was Carlos. Why did he do it?
To flush out Bourne. The San Jacques woman and Bourne are together.
Bourne being this assassin who calls himself Kane, correct?
Yes, said Webb. Carlos has sworn to kill him. Cain's moved in on Carlos all over Europe and the Middle East, but there's no photograph of Cain. No one really knows what he looks like. So by circulating a picture of the woman, and let me tell you, it's in every damn newspaper over there, someone may spot her. If she's found, the chances are that Cain, born, will be found too. Carlos will kill them both. All right. Again, that's Carlos. Now what did you do? Just what I said. Reached the Gemeinschaft and convinced the bank into confirming the fact that the woman might, just might, be tied with a massive theft. It wasn't easy, but it was their man Koenig who'd been bribed, not one of our people. That's an internal matter. They wanted a lid on it. Then I called the papers and referred them to Walther Apfel. Mysterious woman, murder, millions stolen. The editors leaped at it.
For Christ's sake, why? Shouted Stevens. You used a citizen of another country for a U.S. intelligence strategy. A staff employee of a closely allied government. Are you out of your minds? You only exacerbated the situation. You sacrificed her.
You're wrong, said Webb. We're trying to save her life. We've turned Carlos' weapon against him.
How?
The monk raised his hand. Before we answer, we have to go back to another question, he said, because the answer to that may give you an indication of how restricted the information must remain. A moment ago I asked the major how Carlos' man could have found Bourne, found the fiche that identified Bourne as Cain. I think I know, but I want him to tell you.
Webb leaned forward.
The Medusa records, he said, quietly, reluctantly.
Medusa?
Stevens' expression conveyed the fact that the Medusa had been the subject of early White House confidential briefings.
They're buried, he said.
Correction, intruded Abbott. There's an original and two copies, and they're in vaults at the Pentagon, the CIA, and the National Security Council. Access to them is limited to a select group, each one among the highest-ranking members of his unit. Bourne came out of Medusa. A cross-checking of those names with the bank records would produce his name. Someone gave them to Carlos.
Stevens stared at the monk. Are you saying that Carlos is wired into men like that? It's an extraordinary charge.
It's the only explanation, said Webb.
But why would Bourne ever use his own name?
It was necessary, replied Abbott. It was a vital part of the portrait. It had to be authentic. Everything had to be authentic. Everything.
Authentic?
Maybe you'll understand now, continued the major. By tying the Saint-Jacques woman into millions supposedly stolen from the Gemeinschaft Bank, we're telling Bourne to surface. He knows it's false.
Bourne to surface?
The man called Jason Bourne, said Abbott, getting to his feet and walking slowly toward the drawn curtains. He's an American intelligence officer. There is no Cain. Not the one Carlos believes. He's a lure, a trap for Carlos. That's who he is. Or was. The silence was brief, broken by the White House man.
I think you'd better explain. The president has to know.
I suppose so, mused Abbott, parting the curtains, looking absently outside. It's an insoluble dilemma, really. Presidents change. Different men with different temperaments and appetites sit in the Oval Office. However, a long-range intelligence strategy doesn't change, not one like this. Yet an offhand remark over a glass of whiskey in a post-presidential conversation, or an egotistical phrase in a memoir, can blow that same strategy right to hell. There isn't a day that we don't worry about those men who have survived the White House.
Please, interrupted Stevens,
I ask you to remember that I'm here on the orders of this president. Whether you approve or disapprove doesn't matter. He has the right by law to know, and in his name I insist on that right. Very well, said Abbott, still looking outside. 3 years ago, we borrowed a page from the British. We created a man who never was. If you recall, prior to the Normandy invasion, British intelligence floated a corpse into the coast of Portugal, knowing that whatever documents were concealed on it would find their way to the German embassy in Lisbon. A life was created for that dead body. A name, a naval officer's rank, schools, training, travel orders, driver's license, membership cards in exclusive London clubs, and a half-dozen personal letters. Scattered throughout were hints, vaguely worded allusions, and a few very direct chronological and geographical references. They all pointed to the invasion taking place 100 miles away from the beaches at Normandy, and 6 weeks off the target date in June. After panicked checks were made by German agents all over England, and incidentally controlled and monitored by MI5, the High Command in Berlin bought the story and shifted a large part of their defenses. As many as were lost, thousands upon thousands of lives were saved by that man who never was. Abbott let the curtain fall into place and walked wearily back to his chair. "I've heard the story," said the White House aide. "And?" "Ours was a variation," said the monk, sitting down wearily. "Create a living man, a quickly established legend, seemingly everywhere at once, racing all over Southeast Asia, outdoing Carlos at every turn, especially in the area of sheer numbers. Whenever there was a killing, or an unexplained death, or a prominent figure involved in a fatal accident, there was Kane. Reliable sources, paid informants known for accuracy, were fed his name. Embassies, listening posts, entire intelligence networks were repeatedly funneled reports that concentrated on Kane's rapidly expanding activities. His kills were mounting every month, sometimes it seemed weekly. He was everywhere. And he was. In all ways."
"You mean this Bourne was?"
"Yes. He spent months learning everything there was to learn about Carlos, studying every file we had, every known and suspected assassination with which Carlos was involved. He pored over Carlos' tactics, his methods of operation, everything. Much of that material has never seen the light of day, and probably never will. It's explosive. Governments and international combines would be at each other's throats. There was literally nothing Bourne did not know that could be known about Carlos. And then he'd show himself, always with a different appearance, speaking any of several languages, talking about things to selected circles of hardened criminals that only a professional killer would talk about. Then he'd be gone, leaving behind bewildered and often frightened men and women. They had seen Kane. He existed, and he was ruthless. That was the image Bourne conveyed."
"He's been underground like this for 3 years?" asked Stevens.
"Yes. He moved to Europe, the most accomplished white assassin in Asia, graduate of the infamous Medusa, challenging Carlos in his own yard. And in the process, he saved 4 men marked by Carlos, took credit for others Carlos had killed, mocked him at every opportunity, always trying to force him out in the open. He spent nearly 3 years living the most dangerous sort of lie a man can live, the kind of existence few men ever know. Most would have broken under it. And that possibility can never be ruled out."
"What kind of man is he?"
"A professional,"
answered Gordon Webb. Someone who had the training and the capability, who understood that Carlos had to be found, stopped.
But 3 years?
If that seems incredible, said Abbott, you should know that he submitted to surgery. It was like a final break with the past, with the man he was in order to become a man he wasn't. I don't think there's any way a nation can repay a man like Bourne for what he's done. Perhaps the only way is to give him the chance to succeed. And by God, I intend to do that. The monk stopped for precisely 2 seconds, then added, If it is Bourne. It was as if Elliot Stevens had been struck by an unseen hammer.
What did you say?
He asked. I'm afraid I've held this to the end. I wanted you to understand the whole picture before I described the gap. It may not be a gap. We just don't know. Too many things have happened that make no sense to us, but we don't know. It's the reason why there can be absolutely no interference from other levels. No diplomatic sugar pills that might expose the strategy. We could condemn a man to death. A man who's given more than any of us. If he succeeds, he can go back to his own life. But only anonymously. Only without his identity ever being revealed.
I'm afraid you'll have to explain that, said the astonished presidential aide.
Loyalty, Elliot. It's not restricted to what's commonly referred to as the good guys. Carlos has built up an army of men and women who are devoted to him. They may not know him, but they revere him. However, if he can take Carlos, or trap Carlos so we can take him, then vanish, he's home free.
But you say he may not be Bourne.
I said we don't know. It was Bourne at the bank. The signatures were authentic. But is it Bourne now? The next few days will tell us. If he surfaces, added Webb. It's delicate, continued the old man. There are so many variables. If it isn't Bourne, or if he's turned, it could explain the call to Ottawa, the killing at the airport. From what we can gather, the woman's expertise was used to withdraw the money in Paris. All Carlos had to do was make a few inquiries at the Canadian Treasury Board. The rest would be child's play for him. Kill her contact, panic her, cut her off, and use her to contain Bourne.
Were you able to get word to her? Asked the major.
I tried and failed. I had Mac Hawkins call a man who also worked closely with the Saint-Jacques woman, a man named Alan somebody or other. He instructed her to return to Canada immediately. She hung up on him.
God damn it! Exploded Webb.
Precisely. If we could have gotten her back, we might have learned so much. She's the key. Why is she with him? Why he with her? Nothing makes sense.
Less so to me, said Stevens, his bewilderment turning into anger. If you want the president's cooperation, and I promise nothing, you'd better be clearer.
Abbott turned to him. Some 6 months ago, Bourne disappeared, he said. Something happened. We're not sure what, but we can piece together a probability. He got word into Zurich that he was on his way to Marseille. Later, too late, we understood. He'd learned that Carlos had accepted a contract on Howard Leland, and Bourne tried to stop it. Then nothing. He vanished. Had he been killed? Had he broken under the strain? Had he given up?
I can't accept that, interrupted Webb angrily. I won't accept it.
I know you won't, said the monk. It's why I want you to go through that file. You know his codes.
They're all in there. See if you can spot any deviations in Zurich.
Please, broke in Stevens. What do you think? You must have found something concrete, something on which to base a judgment.
I need that, Mr. Abbott. The President needs it.
I wish to heaven I had, replied the monk.
What have we found? Everything and nothing. Almost 3 years of the most carefully constructed deception in our records. Every false act documented, every move defined and justified. Each man and woman, informants, contacts, sources, given faces, voices, stories to tell. And every month, every week, just a little bit closer to Carlos. Then nothing. Silence. 6 months of a vacuum.
Not now, countered the president's aide. That silence was broken. By whom?
That's the basic question, isn't it? Said the old man, his voice tired. Months of silence. Then suddenly an explosion of unauthorized, incomprehensible activity. The account penetrated, the fiche altered, millions transferred. By all appearances, stolen. Above all, men killed and traps set for other men. But for whom? By whom? The monk shook his head wearily. Who is the man out there?
Chapter 20. The limousine was parked between two street lamps, diagonally across from the heavy ornamental doors of the brownstone. In the front seat sat a uniformed chauffeur. Such a driver at the wheel of such a vehicle not an uncommon sight on the tree-lined street. What was unusual, however, was the fact that two other men remained in the shadows of the deep back seat, neither making any move to get out. Instead, they watched the entrance of the brownstone, confident that they could not be picked up by the infrared beam of a scanning camera. One man adjusted his glasses, the eyes beyond his thick lenses owl-like, flatly suspicious of most of what they surveyed. Alfred Gillette, Director of Personnel Screening and Evaluation for the National Security Council, spoke. How gratifying to be there when arrogance collapses. How much more so to be the instrument.
You really dislike him, don't you?
Said Gillette's companion, a heavy-shouldered man in a black raincoat whose accent was derived from a Slavic language somewhere in Europe.
I loathe him. He stands for everything I hate in Washington. The right schools, houses in Georgetown, farms in Virginia, quiet meetings at their clubs. They've got their tight little world and you don't break in. They run it all. The bastards. The superior, self-inflated gentry of Washington. They use other men's intellects, other men's work, wrapping it all into decisions bearing their imprimaturs. And if you're on the outside, you become part of that amorphous entity, a damn fine staff.
You exaggerate, said the European, his eyes on the brownstone.
You haven't done badly down there. We never would have contacted you otherwise.
Gillette scowled. If I haven't done badly, it's because I've become indispensable to too many like David Abbott. I have in my head 1,000 facts they couldn't possibly recall. It's simply easier for them to place me where the questions are, where problems need solutions. Director of Personnel Screening and Evaluation. They created that title, that post for me. Do you know why?
No, Alfred, replied the European, looking at his watch. I don't know why.
Because they don't have the patience to spend hours poring over thousands of resumes and dossiers. They'd rather be dining at Sans Souci, or preening in front of Senate committees, reading from pages prepared by others. By those unseen, unnamed, damn fine staffs.
You're a bitter man, said the European.
More than you'll know. A lifetime doing the work those bastards should have done for themselves. And for what? A title and an occasional lunch where my brains are picked between the shrimp and the entree. By men like the supremely arrogant David Abbott. They're nothing without people like me. Don't underestimate the monk. Carlos doesn't. How could he? He doesn't know what to evaluate. Everything Abbott does is shrouded in secrecy. No one knows how many mistakes he's made, and if any come to light, men like me are blamed for them. The European shifted his gaze from the window to Gillette. You're very emotional, Alfred, he said coldly. You must be careful about that. The bureaucrat smiled. It never gets in the way. I believe my contributions to Carlos bear that out. Let's say I'm preparing myself for a confrontation I wouldn't avoid for anything in the world.
An honest statement, said the heavy-shouldered man. What about you? You found me. I knew what to look for.
The European returned to the window.
I mean you. The work you do for Carlos.
I have no such complicated reasoning. I come out of a country where educated men are promoted at the whim of morons who recite Marxist litany by rote. Carlos, too, knew what to look for.
Gillette laughed, his flat eyes close to shining. We're not so different, after all. Change the bloodlines of our Eastern establishment for Marx, and there's a distinct parallel.
Perhaps, agreed the European, looking again at his watch. It shouldn't be long now. Abbott always catches the midnight shuttle. He's every hour accounted for in Washington.
You're sure he'll come out alone?
He always does, and he certainly wouldn't be seen with Elliot Stevens. Webb and Stevens will also leave separately. 20-minute intervals is standard for those called in.
How did you find Treadstone?
It wasn't so difficult. You contributed, Alfred. You were part of a damn fine staff.
The man laughed, his eyes on the brownstone.
Kane was out of Medusa. You told us that. And if Carlos' suspicions are accurate, that meant the monk. We knew that. It tied him to Bourne. Carlos instructed us to keep Abbott under 24-hour surveillance. Something had gone wrong. When the gunshots in Zurich were heard in Washington, Abbott got careless. We followed him here. It was merely a question of persistence.
That led you to Canada? To the man in Ottawa?
The man in Ottawa revealed himself by looking for Treadstone. When we learned who the girl was, we had the Treasury Board watched, her section watched. A call came from Paris. It was she, telling him to start the search. We don't know why, but we suspect Bourne may be trying to blow Treadstone apart. If he's turned, it's one way to get out and keep the money. It doesn't matter. Suddenly, this section head no one outside the Canadian government had ever heard of was transformed into a problem of the highest priority. Intelligence communiques were burning the wires. It meant Carlos was right. You were right, Alfred. There is no Kane. He's an invention, a trap.
From the beginning, insisted Gillette, I told you that. 3 years of false reports, sources unverified. It was all there.
From the beginning, mused the European. Undoubtedly the monk's finest creation. Until something happened, and the creation turned. Everything's turning. It's all coming apart at the seams.
Stevens being here confirms that. The president insists on knowing.
He has to.
There is a nagging suspicion in Ottawa that a section head at the Treasury Board was killed by American intelligence. The European turned from the window and looked at the bureaucrat. Remember, Alfred, we simply want to know what happened. I've given you the facts as we've learned them. They're irrefutable, and Abbott cannot deny them. But they must be presented as having been obtained independently by your own sources. You're appalled. You demand an accounting. The entire intelligence community has been duped. It has, exclaimed Gillette. Duped and used. No one in Washington knows about Bourne, about Treadstone. They've excluded everyone. It is appalling. I don't have to pretend. Arrogant bastards. Alfred, cautioned the European, holding up his hand in the shadows. Do remember whom you're working for. The threat cannot be based on emotion, but in cold, professional outrage. He'll suspect you instantly. You must dispel those suspicions just as swiftly. You are the accuser, not he. I'll remember. Good. Headlight beams bounced through the glass. Abbott's taxi is here. I'll take care of the driver. The European reached to his right and flipped a switch beneath the armrest. I'll be in my car across the street, listening. He spoke to the chauffeur. Abbott will be coming out any moment now. You know what to do. The chauffeur nodded. Both men got out of the limousine simultaneously. The driver walked around the hood as if to escort a wealthy employer to the south side of the street. Gillette watched through the rear window. The two men stayed together for several seconds, then separated, the European heading for the approaching cab, his hand held up, a bill between his fingers. The taxi would be sent away. The caller's plans had changed. The chauffeur had raced to the north side of the street and was now concealed in the shadows of a staircase two doors away from Treadstone 71. 30 seconds later, Gillette's eyes were drawn to the door of the brownstone. Light spilled through as an impatient David Abbott came outside, looking up and down the street, glancing at his watch, obviously annoyed. The taxi was late, and he had a plane to catch. Precise schedules had to be followed. Abbott walked down the steps, turning left on the pavement, looking for the cab, expecting it. In seconds, he would pass the chauffeur. He did, both men well out of camera range. The interception was quick, the discussion rapid. In moments, a bewildered David Abbott climbed inside the limousine, and the chauffeur walked away into the shadows. "You," said the monk, anger and disgust in his voice. "Of all people, you. I don't think you're in any position to be disdainful, much less arrogant. What you've done! How dare you? Zurich. The Medusa Records. It was you!" "The Medusa Records, yes. Zurich, yes. But it's not a question of what I've done. It's what you've done. We sent our own men to Zurich, telling them what to look for. We found it. His name is Bourne, isn't it? He's the man you call Cain, the man you invented." Abbott kept himself in check. "How did you find this house?" "Persistence. I had you followed." "You had me followed? What the hell did you think you were doing?" "Trying to set a record straight. A record you've warped and lied about, keeping the truth from the rest of us. What did you think you were doing?" "Oh my God. You damn fool." Abbott inhaled deeply. "Why did you do it? Why didn't you come to me yourself?" "Because you'd have done nothing. You've manipulated the entire intelligence community. Millions of dollars, untold thousands of man-hours, embassies and stations fed lies and distortions about a killer that never existed. Oh, I recall your words. What a challenge to Carlos. What an irresistible trap is what it was. Only we were your pawns, too. And as a responsible member of the Security Council, I resent it
deeply. You're all alike. Who elected you God so you could break the rules? No, not just the rules, the laws, and make us look like fools.
There was no other way, said the old man wearily, his face a drawn mass of crevices in the dim light. How many know? Tell me the truth. I've contained it. I gave you that. It may not be enough. Ah, Christ! It may not last, period, said the bureaucrat emphatically. I want to know what happened.
What happened? To this grand strategy of yours? It seems to be falling apart at the seams.
Why do you say that?
It's perfectly obvious. You've lost Bourne. You can't find him. Your Kane has disappeared with a fortune banked for him in Zurich.
Abbott was silent for a moment.
Wait a minute. What put you on to it?
You, said Gillette quickly, the prudent man rising to the baited question. I must say I admired your control when that ass from the Pentagon spoke so knowingly of Operation Medusa, sitting directly across from the man who created it.
History. The old man's voice was strong now. That wouldn't have told you anything.
Let's say it was rather unusual for you not to say anything. I mean, who at that table knew more about Medusa than you? But you didn't say a word. And that started me thinking. So I objected strenuously to the attention being paid this assassin, Kane. You couldn't resist, David. You had to offer a very plausible reason to continue the search for Kane. You threw Carlos into the hunt.
It was the truth, interrupted Abbott.
Certainly it was. You knew when to use it, and I knew when to spot it. Ingenious. A snake pulled out of Medusa's head, groomed for a mythical title. The contender jumps into the champion's ring to draw the champion out of his corner.
It was sound. Sound from the beginning.
Why not? As I say, it was ingenious, even down to every move made by his own people against Kane. Who better to relay those moves to Kane but the one man on the 40 committee who's given reports on every covert operations conference? You used us all.
The monk nodded. Very well. To a point, you're right. There have been degrees of abuse. In my opinion, totally justified. But it's not what you think. There are checks and balances. There always are. I wouldn't have it any other way. Treadstone is comprised of a small group of men among the most trustworthy in the government. They range from Army G2 to the Senate, from the CIA to Naval Intelligence, and now, frankly, the White House. Should there be any true abuse, there's not one of them that would hesitate to put a stop to the operation. None has ever seen fit to do so, and I beg you not to do so either. Would I be made part of Treadstone? You are part of it now.
I see.
What happened? Where is Bourne? I wish to God we knew. We're not even sure it is Bourne.
You're not even sure of what?
I see. What happened? Where is Bourne? I wish to God we knew. We're not even sure it is Bourne.
You're not even sure of what?
The European reached for the switch on the dashboard and snapped it off.
That's it, he said. That's what we had to know.
He turned to the chauffeur beside him.
Quickly now. Get beside the staircase. Remember, if one of them comes out, you have precisely 3 seconds before the door is closed. Work fast.
The uniformed man got out first. He walked up the pavement toward Treadstone 71. From one of the adjacent brownstones, a middle-aged couple were saying loud goodbyes to their hosts. The chauffeur slowed down, reached into his pocket for a cigarette, and stopped to light it. He was now a bored driver,
whiling away the hours of a tedious vigil. The European watched, then unbuttoned his raincoat and withdrew a long, thin revolver, its barrel enlarged by a silencer. He switched off the safety, shoved the weapon back into his holster, got out of the car and walked across the street toward the limousine. The mirrors had been angled properly. By staying in the blind spot, there was no way either man inside could see him approach. The European paused briefly for the rear trunk, then swiftly, hand extended, lunged for the right front door, opened it and spun inside, leveling his weapon over the seat. Alfred Gillette gasped, his left hand surging for the door handle. The European snapped the four-way lock. David Abbott remained immobile, staring at the invader.
"Good evening, Monk," said the European. "Another, who I'm told often assumes a religious habit, sends you his congratulations. Not only for Cain, but for your household personnel at Treadstone. The yachtsman, for instance. Once a superior agent."
Gillette found his voice. It was a mixture of a scream and a whisper.
"What is this? Who are you?" he cried, feigning ignorance.
"Oh, come now, old friend. That's not necessary," said the man with the gun. "I can see by the expression on Mr. Abbott's face that he realizes his initial doubts about you were accurate. One should always trust one's first instincts, shouldn't one, Monk? You were right, of course. We found another discontented man. Your system reproduces them with alarming rapidity. He indeed gave us the Medusa files, and they did indeed lead us to Bourne."
"What are you doing?" screamed Gillette. "What are you saying?"
"You're a bore, Alfred. But you were always part of a damn fine staff. It's too bad you didn't know which staff to stay with. Your kind never do."
"You—"
Gillette rose bodily off the seat, his face contorted. The European fired his weapon, the cough from the barrel echoing briefly in the soft interior of the limousine. The bureaucrat slumped over, his body crumbling to the floor against the door, owl eyes wide in death.
"I don't think you mourn him," said the European.
"I don't," said the monk.
"It is Bourne out there, you know. Cain turned. He broke. The long period of silence is over. The snake from Medusa's head decided to strike out on his own. Or perhaps he was bought. That's possible, too, isn't it? Carlos buys many men. The one at your feet now, for example."
"You'll learn nothing from me. Don't try. There's nothing to learn. We know it all. Delta, Charlie, Cain. But the names aren't important any longer. They never were, really. All that remains is the final isolation. Removing of the man, Monk, who makes the decisions. You. Bourne is trapped. He's finished. There are others who make decisions. He'll reach them. If he does, they'll kill him on sight. There's nothing more despicable than a man who's turned. But in order for a man to turn, there has to be irrefutable proof that he was yours to begin with. Carlos has the proof. He was yours. His origin's as sensitive as anything in the Medusa files." The old man frowned. He was frightened. Not for his life, but for something infinitely more indispensable.
"You're out of your mind," he said. "There is no proof." "That was the flaw. Your flaw. Carlos is thorough. His tentacles reach into all manner of hidden recesses. You needed a man from Medusa, someone who had lived and disappeared. You chose a man named Bourne because the circumstances of his disappearance had been obliterated, eliminated from every existing record. Or so you believed. But you didn't consider Hanoi's own field personnel who had infiltrated Medusa. Those records exist. On March 25th, 1968, Jason Bourne was executed by an American intelligence officer in the jungles of Tam Quan. The monk lunged forward. There was nothing left but a final gesture, a final defiance. The European fired. The door of the brownstone opened. From the shadows beneath the staircase, the chauffeur smiled. The White House aide was being escorted out by the old man who lived at Treadstone, the one they called the yachtsman. The killer knew that meant the primary alarms were off. The 3-second span was eliminated. "So good of you to drop by," said the yachtsman, shaking hands. "Thank you very much, sir." Those were the last words either man spoke. The chauffeur aimed above the walled brick railing, pulling the trigger twice, the muffled reports indistinguishable from the myriad of distant sounds of the city. The yachtsman fell back inside. The White House aide clutched his upper chest, reeling into the doorframe. The chauffeur spun around the brick railing and raced up the steps, catching Stephen's body as it plummeted down. With bull-like strength, the killer lifted the White House man off his feet, hurling him back through the door into the foyer beyond the yachtsman. Then he turned to the interior border of the heavy, steel-plated door. He knew what to look for. He found it. Along the upper molding, disappearing into the wall, was a thick cable stained the color of the doorframe. He closed the door partway, raised his gun, and fired into the cable. The spit was followed by an eruption of static and sparks. The security cameras were blown out, screens everywhere now dark. He opened the door to signal. It was not necessary. The European was walking rapidly across the quiet street. Within seconds he had climbed the steps and was inside, glancing around the foyer and the hallway, the door at the end of the hallway. Together, both men lifted a rug from the foyer floor, the European closing the door on its edge, welding cloth and steel together so that a 2-inch space remained, the security bolts still in place. No backup alarms could be raised. They stood erect in silence. Both knew that if the discovery was going to be made, it would be made quickly. It came with the sound of an upstairs door opening, followed by footsteps and words that floated down the staircase in a cultured female voice.
"Darling, I just noticed the damn camera's on the fritz. Would you check it, please?"
There was a pause. Then the woman spoke again.
"On second thought, why not tell David?"
Again the pause, again with precise timing.
"Don't bother the Jesuit, darling. Tell David."
2 footsteps. Silence. A rustle of cloth. The European studied the stairwell. A light went out. David. Jesuit.
Monk.
"Get her!" he roared at the chauffeur, spinning around, his weapon leveled at the door at the end of the hallway. The uniformed man raced up the staircase. There was a gunshot. It came from a powerful weapon. Unmuffled, unsilenced. The European looked up. The chauffeur was holding his shoulder, his coat drenched with blood, his pistol held out, spitting repeatedly up the well of the stairs. The door at the end of the hallway was yanked open, the major standing there in shock, a file folder in his hand. The European fired twice. Gordon Webb arched backward, his throat torn open, the papers in the folder flying out behind him. The man in the raincoat raced up the steps to the chauffeur. Above, over the railing, was the gray-haired woman, dead, blood spilling out of her head and neck.
"Are you all right? Can you move?" asked the European.
The chauffeur nodded.
"The bitch blew half my shoulder off, but I can manage."
"You have to,"
commanded his superior, ripping off his raincoat.
"Put on my coat. I want the monk in here. Quickly!"
"Jesus!
Carlos wants the monk in here."
Awkwardly, the wounded man put on the black raincoat and made his way down the staircase around the bodies of the yachtsman and the White House aide. Carefully, in pain, he let himself out the door and down the front steps. The European watched him,
holding the door, making sure the man was sufficiently mobile for the task. He was. He was a bull whose every appetite was satisfied by Carlos. The chauffeur would carry David Abbott's corpse back into the brownstone, no doubt supporting it as though helping an aging drunk for the benefit of anyone in the street. And then he would somehow contain his bleeding long enough to drive Alfred Gillette's body across the river, burying him in a swamp. Carlos' men were capable of such things. They were all bulls. Discontented bulls who had found their own causes in a single man. The European turned and started down the hallway. There was work to do. The final isolation of the man called Jason Bourne. It was more than could be hoped for. The exposed files a gift beyond belief. Included were folders containing every code and method of communication ever used by the mythical Cain. Now not so mythical, thought the European as he gathered the papers together. The scene was set, the four corpses in position in the peaceful, elegant library. David Abbott was arched in a chair, his dead eyes in shock, Elliot Stevens at his feet. The yachtsman was slumped over the hatch table, an overturned bottle of whiskey in his hand, while Gordon Webb sprawled on the floor, clutching his briefcase. Whatever violence had taken place, the setting indicated that it had been unexpected. Conversations interrupted by abrupt gunfire. The European walked around in suede gloves, appraising his artistry, and it was artistry. He had dismissed the chauffeur, wiped every door handle, every knob, every gleaming surface of wood. It was time for the final touch. He walked to a table where there were brandy glasses on a silver tray, picked one up and held it to the light. As he expected, it was spotless. He put it down and took out a small, flat plastic case from his pocket. He opened it and removed a strip of transparent tape, holding it, too, up to the light. There they were, as clear as portraits, for they were portraits, as undeniable as any photograph. They had been taken off a glass of Perrier, removed from an office at the Gemeinschaft Bank in Zurich. They were the fingerprints of Jason Bourne's right hand. The European picked up the brandy glass and, with the patience of the artist he was, pressed the tape around the lower surface, then gently peeled it off. Again he held the glass up. The prints were seen in dull perfection against the light of the table lamp. He carried the glass over to a corner of the parquet floor and dropped it. He knelt down, studied the fragments, removed several, and brushed the rest under the curtain. They were enough.
Chapter 21. "Later," said Bourne, throwing their suitcases on the bed. "We've got to get out of here." Marie sat in the armchair. She had reread the newspaper article again, selecting phrases, repeating them. Her concentration was absolute. She was consumed, more and more confident of her analysis.
"I'm right, Jason. Someone is sending us a message."
"We'll talk about it later. We've stayed here too long as it is. That newspaper will be all over this hotel in an hour, and the morning papers may be worse. It's no time for modesty. You stand out in a hotel lobby, and you've been